and the deliberate starvation, our hopes now are with the judges that they will see that Israel is lying.
And what about with the United States? I mean, you have President Biden now announcing $1 billion of military weapons in the pipeline for Israel, including $700 million for tank ammunition, $500 million in tactical vehicles, $60 million in mortar rounds. The significance of what position the U.S. takes and what Biden is doing.
He supports Israel and it's to continue the war. I mean, I see no other explanation to this. I mean, all his words that he's worried about Rafah or Famine or whatever. So it's such hypocrisy that I feel almost speechless. You think on the one hand they are sending aid, or they say that they are sending aid, but it takes so long and it is so little. And on the other hand, they encourage Israel to continue with the war against Gaza, where we see that already Israel is defeated. I mean, it's defeated. If such a huge military power is still fighting Hamas after 8 months, it doesn't give anything good to the Israelis. I mean, except of some groups that want it to continue.
Five seconds.
Yeah. But for the majority of Israelis, it's clear that the majority of Israelis understand, even though they support the war on the one hand, they understand it's against them too.
Longtime Israeli journalist.
Hi, I'm Queen Ida, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM on the radio. Your spot for Cajun and Zydeco music. Bon ton roulet.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's Development Committee meeting will be held on Monday, May 20th at 4:30 p.m. The meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
The flowers are blooming. The birds are singing, and KBOO's Spring Membership Drive is back. If you enjoy alternative radio that pushes the status quo, then support KBOO by becoming a member today. Donate online at bit.ly/KBOO between now and May 25th and support Avant-Garde Airwaves. You can also text KBOO to 44321. Thank you so much for your support.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this Spring Membership Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, Multnomah County Commission candidate Jessie Burke faces accusations of unfairly funneling contracts to her husband on the Old Town Board she chairs.
The share of Oregon kindergartners with non-medical vaccine exemptions hits a record high.
And the Beaverton School District makes strides in bilingual education for students.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 17th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and we'd like to remind you that you can renew your membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to bit.ly/KBOO. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Ezra. Multnomah County Commission candidate Jessie Burke is the owner of Society Hotel in downtown Portland. She's also the board chair of the Old Town Community Association, where her husband, Jonathan Cohen, serves as a treasurer. But this week, the Portland Mercury reports that the Old Town Community Association, overseen by Burke, funneled over $40,000 in contracts to her husband, Cohen. The board voted last Friday to award several project management contracts to Cohen, around $1.2 million in Old Town public improvement projects. Cohen was also chosen to oversee and hire contractors for the reconstruction of the Chinatown Gate, among other projects. The Mercury reports that the bids for the project management gigs weren't widely publicized. Cohen was one of two bids. Burke, who's running for Multnomah County Commission, says this wasn't a conflict of interest. She says neither she nor her husband participated in the board decision to fire him the contract. It's not illegal for nonprofit organizations to award contracts to one of their own board members, but legal representatives say it can be an issue for their reputation.
Oregon schools are reporting the highest ever rate of students claiming non-medical exemptions from the state school vaccination requirements. That's according to data released by the Oregon Health Authority on Thursday. Their analysis found that 8.8% of kindergartners in Oregon had a non-medical exemption for at least one of their required vaccines. That's up from years past. In 2023, the CDC reported that Oregon had the second highest non-medical vaccine exemption rate in the country, with Idaho being the highest. Stacy Diasis-Matthews from the Oregon Immunization Program said in a press release, quote, "The concern is that a highly contagious disease, such as measles, will be introduced to a school that doesn't have high immunization rates and that students will become sick." She adds that as of May 10th, there were 132 cases of measles in the U.S. in 2024. Of those, 81% were unvaccinated or had unknown vaccination status. That's according to CDC data. Matthew stresses that vaccinations are important to help reduce health disparities and to keep the school environment free from diseases that are preventable via vaccination. If a person needs help finding a clinic, they can contact 211 or their local health department.
Vos Elementary in the Beaverton School District is blazing a trail with a Spanish dual immersion curriculum focused on playful inquiry and habits of mind in conjunction with the Children's Institute. Mark Richardson has the details.
The Beaverton School District is blazing a trail in early education through bilingual learning labs that emphasize playful inquiry and habits of mind. School officials say the Early School Success Initiative is designed to showcase the power of early learning and help make the case for expanded public investment in preschool. Vos Elementary Principal Monique Singleton says the program helps children, many from immigrant families, successfully adjust to their new surroundings.
The goal would be to help them feel honored in a sense of belonging and a sense of safety around themselves and their emotions and their identity, and so they don't feel like they have to shut down a part of themselves in order to be successful at school.
Elementary hosted a learning lab earlier this week showing participants in the district the transformative work the school is doing to improve outcomes for students in the community. The goals for the event were to hold space to nurture cross-district relationships and collaboration. Singleton says the emphasis is on teaching children life skills that help them cope with complex emotions and complex situations that they are either dealing with at school or at home or both.
The goal would be to help them feel honored in a sense of belonging and a sense of safety around themselves and their emotions and their identity, and so they don't feel like they have to shut down a part of themselves in order to be successful at school.
Vos's faculty and staff are hands-on leaders who model empathy, learn alongside their staff, and consistently message the need for playful inquiry as an equity stance. Singleton says they aim to provide children at Vos with the same kind of learning experiences one might expect at an elite private school. For Oregon News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
More education news now, as the Jervis School District, a small district home to about 1,000 students, is set to close if they don't get funding approved in this year's election. The last time the district received a bond was in 1991. It was for $1.3 million, which built a gym and cafeteria at the elementary school. The school district's buildings are water damaged now, and classrooms can be as cold as 50 degrees. The Jervis School District has a $28 million bond on the upcoming ballot. This is still less expensive than some of the neighboring districts. If it passes, the bond would combine with the Oregon School Capital Improvement Matching Grant and give the Jervis School District about $34 million to make repairs. Dandy Stevens has been the district superintendent for 5 years, and she says that after more than 30 years without a bond, he says, quote, "We want to make sure people understand this is not a Band-Aid. This is bringing all of our facilities up to where they need to be," end quote.
Employees at the Portland Japanese Garden are set to vote on a union next month, while management is urging employees to vote no, according to reporting by the Portland Mercury. 19 employees from the Garden Cafe and Gift Shop announced their intention to unionize with Laborers International Union of North America, Local 483, last month. The group told the Mercury, quote, "We believe the workplace issues to be mainly systemic rather than personal, but the uncomfortable behavior many of us have been subjected to since we started advocating for ourselves has only reinforced our need for greater protections and outside support," end quote. Following their announcement, the Garden's executive director, Lisa Christie, put out an email to employees urging them to vote no, writing, quote, "After carefully considering the petition, Portland Japanese Garden does not believe a union is a good fit for our staff and our operations, and we hope you vote no in this upcoming election." According to union organizers, these sentiments have been reiterated by management in person, and employees have been asked repeatedly if they had seen the email. Among concerns raised by the bargaining group are the use of racial epithets in discussing the garden's history and elitist attitude among the garden's management, and pay disparities between management and customer-facing staff. The 19-member bargaining unit will have their vote on June 6th.
To our natural resources now, where the policy of thinning forests to prevent mega wildfires regularly creates lots of piles of highly flammable sticks. Scientists say they have found a way to turn these potential bonfires into nutrient-rich soil. Forest manager Jeff Ravage with the Coalition for the Upper South Platte in Colorado says if done properly, mushrooms can eliminate wood piles safely through fungal decay, a process he calls cold fire.
So it's really doing the same thing as fire, and it doesn't release heat, so it doesn't cause runaway catastrophic fires. And we're now finding evidence that it could be useful in sequestering carbon back into the soil.
Creating the right conditions and adding mushroom spores into wood piles paves the way for mycelium, the often unseen root-like structure of the fungi, to turn the wood into a compost-rich carbon and other nutrients. About a third of current thinning costs go to hauling out or burning the slash, and Ravage says cold fire can dramatically reduce those costs. Vast landscapes of forests across the U.S. have grown thicker after decades of fire suppression strategies. To meet the demands of forest fire mitigation, Ravage says efforts are underway to make it possible to scale up cold fire production to 12 tons every week.
Because that's what needs to be done. We have approximately 6 million acres of forest that really needs mitigation in Colorado if we want to preserve the forest.
Ravage believes mushrooms can also play a role in mitigating the loss of productive agricultural lands. He says the compost created in forests could help restore farmland soil that has essentially been degraded to material that can support standing plants.
Because of our use of petroleum fertilizer and all the insecticides and pesticides we put on, we've basically killed the soil. This mushroom compost can add back the carbon, and it can add back nutrients. And most importantly, our compost is alive. It contains all the microbiome.
That was Colorado-based forest manager Jeff Ravage.
A new poll shows abortion could be a defining issue in the November election. Results from a coalition of civil rights groups finds that women of color say politicians who want to earn their vote need to focus on reproductive justice, plus the issues of affordable health care, gun violence prevention, and racism. Lupe Rodriguez leads the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Justice.
With Latinas and other women of color, we've seen their power as a voting bloc on this issue in recent elections. And voters of color, and including Latinos, are rejecting abortion bans and attacks on their freedom.
The poll found that nearly 9 in 10 women of color say voting in the 2024 election is extremely or very important. It was conducted by a coalition of civil rights groups called Intersections of Our Lives. The poll also found that 93% of Black women, 84% of AAPI women, and 79% of Latinas agree with the statement that racism has gone on too long, and that policies to advance racial equity are long overdue. Regina David Moss, who leads the National Black Women's Reproductive Justice Agenda, says the 2022 U.S. Supreme Court ruling that overturned the decades-old constitutional right to abortion is still reverberating.
One of the things that's so different from 20 years ago is so many things are not different from 20 years ago. We should have made more progress. We should not be looking at taking away rights. And so the more things change, the more they stay the same. And that's absolutely unacceptable to women of color.
Over 2023, the Guttmacher Institute estimates there were 1,290 abortions performed in Oregon for out-of-state patients.
The Supreme Court rules funding for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is okay. Election deniers hold key voting oversight positions in swing states. And North Carolina lawmakers vote to ban people from wearing masks in public. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The CFPB is the cop on the beat for the finances of America's families. And it reminds every lender that if they cheat, there is a serious chance that they could get caught.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren calls the Consumer Federal Protection Bureau the little agency that could, having already forced lenders to return more than $17 million to customers. On Thursday, the Supreme Court rejected a case brought by payday lenders and based on a conservative legal theory which could have undermined the Bureau. The justices, led by conservative Clarence Thomas, ruled 7-2 that the way the agency's funded is constitutional. Meanwhile, the court's turning away a case on the rights of protest organizers in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas. Cicely Gay with the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation says that leaves a Fifth Circuit decision in place, allowing protest organizers to be held liable for the actions of protesters.
This case, without question, infringes upon all of our First Amendment rights. It's incumbent upon us to reject its premise and its intention, which is frankly to scare champions of justice and organizers away from mass protest.
The Supreme Court is also saying Louisiana's new congressional map can remain in place for now. A lower court struck the map down as an unconstitutional racial gerrymander, but that ruling is being appealed. The state will likely go into the election with two majority black districts instead of the previous one. A CBS News investigation finds nearly 80 election oversight officials in seven swing states have publicly said the 2020 election was stolen. That worries Nevada Secretary of State Francisco Aguilar.
We are in a national election. That national election is being run at the local level. And at that local level, they can completely shut down the election for the state and for the nation.
The North Carolina Senate has approved legislation to ban anyone from wearing masks in public. Supporters say it will help police crack down on demonstrators using the masks to hide their identities. But state senator and cancer survivor Sidney Batch says the bill puts health and lives at risk.
I should have the freedom, my children should have the freedom, and my husband should have the freedom to wear a mask in order to protect and save my life.
Governor Roy Cooper has not said if he'll sign the bill, but Republicans' legislative supermajority could override any veto. Maryland is the first state to establish a statewide center for gun violence prevention. That's in coordination with a new federal center overseen by Vice President Kamala Harris. Governor Wes Moore says it will treat gun violence as a public health issue.
Gun violence is tearing apart the fabric of our communities, not just through mass shootings, but through shootings that are happening in each of our communities far too often.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $60,000 by May 25th. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to bit.ly/KBOO. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Radio Zine. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 47. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 61. Today in history, in 1973, televised hearings on the Watergate scandal in the U.S. begin. 69 people were charged for their involvement, and 48 were found guilty. The quote of the day is from American author Lloyd Alexander, who died this day in 2007. He said, quote, "Is there not glory enough in living the days given to us? You should know there is adventure in simply being among those we love, and the things we love, and beauty, too."
The Winnebago tribe in Nebraska is teaching soft skills to help combat the U.S. labor shortage. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Workforce watchers say the country could face shortages in many skilled trades in coming years. Nebraska's Winnebago tribe is taking a proactive approach to the issue through a program for high school juniors and seniors. The program includes Ho-Chunk Inc. and local businesses, as Deborah Van Fleet explains.
Willie Bass with Ho-Chunk Inc. says tribal leaders realized they needed programs for their youth who might not pursue higher education.
This program was intended to get students interested in a foot in the door in the fields of construction, IT, nursing, education, etc.
Bass explains the students earn credits for spending 2 hours at their work site 4 days a week. On Fridays, they learn soft skills such as resume building, interviewing, and the importance of a good attitude and good attendance. In the latest Harris poll, more than 80% of employers reported many of their youngest workers lack these important soft skills. Bass says one of the tribe's priorities is ensuring its members have job opportunities.
We want our kids to go off, get educated, and come back and contribute to the tribe and make it a better place and for them to be successful. If they want to contribute those skills on a broader scale in other communities, they have that support system.
Winnebago Public School Superintendent Kamau Turner says they plan to build upon the program in the future.
Our community is growing, our school is growing, and there'll be more of those people needed. Jobs will have to grow as the community grows.
I'm Deborah Van Fleet.
Valerie Davidson is recognized as a trailblazer in Native healthcare and was head of one of the largest tribal health organizations in the nation. But Davidson is no longer president and CEO of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. In a statement on its website last week, the tribal consortium announced she had left the organization. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports, it gave no explanation why, other than to say she was transitioning out of the job.
A number of Alaska Native leaders who were reached for comment called the news about Valerie Davidson's departure shocking in that it was so sudden and abrupt. But the news traveled fast to her old boss, former Governor Bill Walker, who was on a trip to London. Walker says he's both surprised and disappointed.
It's an awkward situation, I'll put it that way, just because she's so gifted.
Walker initially tapped Davidson to be his Health and Social Services Commissioner, where she successfully oversaw the state's push to expand Medicaid, which Walker says has saved the state millions.
I witnessed her literally move mountains on health care issues that benefited Alaska.
The statement from the tribal consortium, while it gives no explanation for replacing Davidson, heaps praise upon her for guiding the organization out of what it describes as a leadership crisis. In the statement, the consortium's board of directors credit Davidson with numerous successes during her watch that include major investments and meaningful improvements, in which it says supported the remarkable transformation of the organization.
Val has been a pioneer, speaking her truth, which I think is very difficult to do in those high-level positions.
Gary Ferguson is an Alaska Native naturopathic doctor who currently works as a researcher at Washington State. He worked with Davidson at the Health Consortium when she served as its corporate attorney. He says he admires her integrity and passion for bringing traditional Native values to health care, and wonders if the constant battle between those values and the bottom line were a factor in her departure. For now, Natasha Singh will step in as interim president and CEO. Singh is also a lawyer and a longtime champion of tribal rights. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Research shows estuaries provide more than $1 billion in environmental benefits. Estuary is the term for a tidal mouth of a large river, where the tide meets the stream. They serve as a flood barrier and store climate-warming carbon pollution. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When a river reaches the ocean, it becomes an estuary, a place where fresh water mixes with salt water.
You'll have wetland habitats, marshes, peatlands, swamps, your traditional swamp, mangroves in certain parts of the U.S.
Tony Castelletto is with the Center for the Blue Economy at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. In 2021, he studied the economic value of just six estuaries and found that they'll provide more than $1 billion of environmental benefits over a 30-year period. Wetlands and mangroves act as flood barriers, protecting coastal cities from storm surges. Estuaries also store carbon in plants and soil, keeping it out of the atmosphere where it would contribute to global warming. Many estuaries are threatened by development and sea level rise. So Castelletto says that highlighting the amount of flood damage that they prevent and the value of the carbon they store could help motivate people to protect them and help officials assess the costs of those efforts.
It's not just a matter of protecting these beautiful things because they're beautiful. It's a very pragmatic decision to preserve benefits and services that you're getting right now, essentially for free.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
On to sports now, where the Portland Timbers have a brand new sponsor for their jersey. This comes after 3 months without a sponsor when the previous one, DiBella Construction, went up in flames following sexual harassment allegations against the owner. Tillamook Dairy has stepped up and has been signed to a multi-year deal with the team. The new Timbers jersey was unveiled on Sunday at Providence Park. Tillamook has been a sponsor with the Timbers since 2014, but it's their first time with their name on every player's chest. Longtime jersey sponsor Alaska Airlines walked away from the role last year, leaving the team open for a new brand to be emblazoned on their kit.
A judge has blocked a ballot measure proposed by Portland's police union from being on the November ballot. The proposed measure would have required that the city increase its number of sworn police officers, expand street support services, and create a 24-hour treatment center for drug and alcohol detoxification. Under the state constitution, ballot measures cannot make administrative changes to city policies, only legislative changes. Choosing staffing levels is an administrative decision. When the proposed measure was first introduced, it was immediately challenged by a Portlander represented by the ACLU. The Portland's Police Association's other proposed measure, which would restrict the city's new police oversight office, has also been challenged and is awaiting the judge's decision on whether or not it can be on the ballot.
New Mexico's number of avian flu cases among dairy cows has not increased in recent weeks, but experts want more nationwide testing. A Texas man became ill with what's often called bird flu after contact with infected dairy cattle. Ross Brown has more.
The number of avian flu cases in dairy cows is holding steady in New Mexico, but experts say more testing is needed to prevent its spread and protect humans. Technically known as H5N1, what's called bird flu has been detected in 8 Curry County herds, although no deaths were reported. In Texas, a man is known to have become ill with bird flu last month after contact with infected dairy cattle. And that worries Andrew Pecas with Johns Hopkins School of Public Health.
Given that dairy farms have a large number of people who can come in contact with infected cows, there is an increased chance of the H5N1 virus also directly infecting humans and beginning that process of adapting to replication and spread within humans themselves.
He says the risk to the general public is still very low, but the U.S. should improve its response to new and emerging infections in order to minimize the chance of another pandemic. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced this week that it will pay dairy farms with confirmed avian flu infections to help contain the virus's spread to people and more cows. In Texas, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention confirmed the virus killed a dozen cats who drank raw cow milk. Due to extensive federal food checks prior to human consumption, Megan Davis, also with Johns Hopkins, believes it's safe to eat poultry and drink milk, with one exception.
Raw milk and raw milk products may not undergo the same processes to inactivate the virus, and so I have very large concerns about the safety of raw milk.
In addition to New Mexico, last month's outbreak affected more than 33 dairy cow herds in 7 other states. To date, federal officials only mandate testing for dairy cows moving between states. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Higher consumer costs are still being felt at the grocery store. Households struggling to manage food expenses are turning to debt as a way to keep everyone fed, according to a new analysis of spending habits among shoppers around the country. Mike Mohn has more in North Dakota.
North Dakota is in the top half of states for average weekly grocery bills. And a new national report details how consumer debt is bridging the gap for households having a hard time covering food expenses. Policy experts say grocery price increases have outpaced overall inflation. The Urban Institute is out with findings showing that in 2023, 60% of adults reported their families used credit cards to buy groceries. 7% were not able to make minimum monthly payments on those charges, and nearly 1 in 5 dipped into savings to maintain their food supplies. The Institute's Cassandra Martinchek says this reflects the financial strain some people are feeling.
Some families are really struggling to even meet their basic needs and are taking riskier financial strategies that could leave them less capable to cope with like a future financial shock. So something like losing their job.
For those taking advantage of buy now, pay later options for groceries, 37% reported missing payments on those loans. A separate report earlier this year found that North Dakota is just below the national average for grocery expenses. However, it's still 23rd highest in the nation, sitting above neighboring states. Even if food prices start to come down, Martinchek says missed debt payments during the price hikes could have lasting effects.
They could have constrained access to affordable credit options and struggle to take advantage of different wealth-building opportunities.
She says that's especially the case for historically disadvantaged households. The report suggests that policymakers strengthen social safety nets to help these families as pandemic aid expires. But increasing payments under programs like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program might be hard in a divided Congress. Another recommendation calls for bolstering credit counseling and debt management services. This is Mike Moen for Prairie News Service.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 17th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking